Carlos Castaneda's book, The Second Ring of Power, Chapter 3, Part 1, La Gorda. The first thing I noticed about La Gorda was her eyes, very dark and calm. She seemed to be examining me from head to toe. Her eyes scanned my body the same way Don Juan's used to. In fact, her eyes had the same calmness and force. I knew why she was the best. The thought that came to my mind was that Don Juan must have left her his eyes. Excuse me. She was slightly taller than the other three girls. She had a lean, dark body and a superb back. I noticed the graceful line of her broad shoulders when she half-turned her upper body to face the three girls. She gave them an unintelligible command, and the three of them sat down on a bench right behind her. She was actually shielding them from me with her body. She turned to face me again. Her expression was one of utmost seriousness, but without a trace of gloom or heaviness. She did not smile, and yet she was friendly. She had very pleasant features, a nicely shaped face, neither round nor angular, a small mouth with thin lips, a broad nose, high cheekbones, and long jet black hair. I could not help noticing her beautiful muscular hands, which she kept clasped in front of her over her umbilical region. The backs of her hands were turned to me. I could see her muscles being contracted rhythmically as she clasped her palms. She was wearing a long faded orange cotton dress with long sleeves and a brown shawl. There was something terribly calming and final about her. I felt the presence of Don Juan. My body relaxed. Sit down," she said to me in a coaxing tone. I walked back to the table. She pointed out a place for me to sit, but I remained standing. She smiled for the first time. Her eyes became softer and shinier. She was not as pretty as Josephine, and yet she was the most beautiful of them all. We were quiet for a moment. In terms of explanation, she said that they had done their best in the years since the Nawal left, and that because of their dedication, they had become accustomed to the task they had left for them to perform, that he had left for them to perform. I did not quite understand what she was talking about, but as she spoke, I felt more than ever the presence of Don Juan. It was not that she was copying his manners or the inflection of his voice. She had an inner control that made her act the way Don Juan did. This similarity was from the inside out. I told her that I had come because I needed Pablito and Nesta's help. I said that I was rather slow and even stupid in understanding the ways of sorcerers, but that I was sincere, and yet all of them had treated me with malice and deceitfulness. She began to apologize, but I did not let her finish. I picked up my things and went to the front door. She ran after me. She was not preventing me from leaving, but rather she was talking very fast, as if she needed to say all that she could before I drove away. She said that I had to hear her out, and that she was willing to ride with me until she had told me everything the Nawal had entrusted her to tell me. "I'm going to Mexico City," I said. "I ride with you to Los Angeles if necessary," she said. I knew that she meant it. "All right," I said, just to test her. "Get in the car." She facilitated for an instant. Then she stood silently and faced the house. She put her clasped hands just below her navel. She turned and faced the valley and did the same movement with her hands. I knew what she was doing. She was saying goodbye to her house and to those awesome round hills that surrounded it. Don Juan had taught me that goodbye gesture many years before. He had stressed that it was an extremely powerful gesture and that a warrior had to use it sparingly. I had very few occasions to perform it myself. The goodbye movement La Gorda was executing was a variant of the one Don Juan had taught me. He had said that the hands were clasped as in a prayer or gently or with great speed, even producing a clapping sound. Done either way, the purpose of the clasping the hands was to imprison the feelings that the warrior did not wish to leave behind. As soon as the hands had closed in and captured that feeling, they were taken with great force to the middle of the chest at the level of the heart. There, the feeling became a dagger, and the warrior stabbed himself with it, as if holding the dagger with both hands. Don Juan had told me that a warrior said goodbye in that fashion only when he had reason to feel that he might not come back. Lagorda's goodbye enthralled me. "Are you saying goodbye?" I asked out of curiosity. "Yes," she said dryly. "Don't put your hands to your chest," "Don't you put your hands to your chest?" I asked. "Men do that. Women have wounds. They store their feelings there." "Are you supposed to say goodbye like that only when you're not coming back?" I asked. "Chances are I may not come back," she replied. "I'm going with you." I had an attack of unwarranted sadness. Unwarranted in the sense that I did not know that woman at all. I had only doubts and suspicions about her. But as I peered into her cleared eyes, I had a sense of ultimate kinship with her. I mellowed. My anger had disappeared and had given way to a strange sadness. I looked around and I knew that those mysterious, enormous round hills were ripping me apart. "Those hills over there are alive," she said, reading my thoughts. I turned to her and told her that both the place and the woman had affected me at a very deep level, a level I could not ordinarily conceive. I did not know which was more devastating, the place or the women. The women's onslaughts had been direct and terrifying, but the effect of those hills was a constant nagging apprehension, a desire to flee from them. When I told that to Lagorda, she said that I was correct in assessing the effect of that place, that the Nawal had left them there because of that effect, and that I should not blame anyone for what had happened, because the Nawal himself had given those women orders to try to do away with me. Did he give orders like that to you, too?" I asked. "No, not me. I'm different than they are," she said. "They are sisters. They are the same, exactly the same. Like Pablito, Nesta, and Benigno are the same. Only you and I can be exactly the same. We are not now because you are still incomplete. But someday we will be the same. Exactly the same. I've been told that you are the only one who knows where the Nawal and Gennaro are now," I said. She peered at me for a moment and shook her head affirmatively. "That's right," she said. "I know where they are. The Nawal told me to take you there, if I can." I told her to stop beating around the bush and to reveal the exact whereabouts to me immediately. My demand seemed to plunge her into chaos. She apologized and reassured me that later on, when we were on our way, she would disclose everything to me. She begged me not to ask her about them anymore because she had strict orders not to mention anything until the right moment. Lydia and Josefina came to the door and stared at me. I hurriedly got in the car. Lagorda got in after me. As she did, I could not help observing that she had entered the car as she would have entered a tunnel. She sort of crawled in. Don Juan used to do that. I jokingly said once, after I had seen him do it scores of times, that it was more functional to get in the way I did. I thought that perhaps his lack of familiarity with automobiles was responsible for his strange way of entering. He explained then that the car was a cave, and that caves had to be entered in that fashion if we were going to use them. There was an inherent spirit to caves, whether they were natural or man-made, and that spirit had to be approached with respect. Crawling was the only way of showing that respect. I was wondering whether or not to ask Lagorda if Don Juan had instructed her about such details, but she spoke first. She said that the Nawal had given her specific instructions about what to do in case I would survive the attacks on Donna Soledad and the three girls. Then she casually added that before I headed for Mexico City, we had to go to a specific place in the mountains where Don Juan and I used to go, and that there she would reveal all the information the Nawal had never disclosed to me. I had a moment of indecision, and then something in me which was not my reason made me head for the mountains. We drove in complete silence. I attempted at various opportune moments to start up a conversation, but she turned me down every time with a strong shake of her head. Finally, she seemed to have gotten tired of my trying and said forcefully that what she had to say required a place of power, and until we were in one, we had to abstain from draining ourselves with the useless talk. After a long drive and an exhausting hike away from the road, we finally reached our destination. It was late afternoon. We were in a deep canyon. The bottom of it was already dark, while the sun was still shining on the top of the mountains above. We walked until we came to a small cave, a few feet from up the north side of the canyon, which ran from east to west. I used to spend a great deal of time there with Don Juan. Before we entered the cave, Lagorda carefully swept the floor with branches, the way Don Juan used to, in order to clear the ticks and parasites from the rocks. Then she cut a large heap of small branches with soft leaves from surrounding bushes and placed them on the rock floor like a mat. She motioned for me to enter. I had always let Don Juan enter first as a sign of respect. I wanted to do the same with her, but she declined. She said I was the Nawal. I crawled into the cave the same way she had crawled into my car. I laughed at my inconsistency. I had never been able to treat my car as a cave. She coached me to relax and make myself comfortable. The reason the Nawal did not reveal all his designs to you was because you're incomplete, Lagorda said all of a sudden. You still are. But now, after your bouts with Soldat and the sisters, you are stronger than before. What's the meaning of being incomplete? Everyone has told me that you're the only one who can explain that. It's a very simple matter, she said. A complete person is one who has never had children. She paused as if she were allowing me time to write down what she had said. I looked up from my notes. She was staring at me, judging the effect of her words. I know what the Nawal told you, exactly what you just said. I know that the Nawal told you exactly what I've just said, she continued. You didn't pay any attention to him, and you probably haven't paid any attention to me either. I read the notes out loud and repeated what she had said. She giggled. The Nawal said that an incomplete person is one who has had children, she said as if dictating to me. She scrutinized me, apparently waiting for a question or a comment. I had none. Now, I've told you everything about the complete and the incomplete, she said, and I've told you just like the Nawal told me. It didn't mean anything to me at the time, and it doesn't mean anything to you now. I had to laugh at the way she patted herself after Don Juan. An incomplete person has a hole in the stomach, she went on. A sorcerer can see it as plainly as you can see my head. When the hole is on the left side of one's stomach, the child who created the hole is of the same sex. If it is on the right side, the child is of the opposite sex. The hole on the left side is black, the one on the right side is dark brown. Can you see the hole in anyone who has had children? Sure. There are two ways of seeing it. A sorcerer may see it in dreaming or by looking directly at a person. A sorcerer who sees has no problems in viewing the luminous being to find out if there is a hole in the luminosity of the body. But even if the sorcerer doesn't know how to see, he can look and actually distinguish the darkness of the hole through the clothing. She stopped talking. I urged her to go on. The Nawal told me that you write and then you don't remember what you wrote, she said with a tone of accusation. I became entangled in words trying to defend myself. Nonetheless, what she had said was true. Don Juan's words always had a double effect on me. Once I heard for the first time whatever he had said. Then when I read at home whatever I had written down and had forgotten about. Talking to Lagorda, however, was intrinsically different. Don Juan's apprentices were not in any way as engulfing as he was. Their revelations, although extraordinary, were only missing pieces to a jigsaw puzzle. The unusual character of those pieces was that with them, the picture did not become clearer. but that it became more and more complex. You had a brown hole in the right side of your stomach, she continued. That means a woman entered you. You made a female child. The narwhal said I had a huge black hole in myself because I made two women. I never saw the hole, but I've seen other people with holes like mine. You said I had a hole. Don't I have it anymore? No, it's been patched. The narwhal helped you to patch it. Without his help, you would be more empty than you are now. What kind of patch is it? A patch in your luminosity. There is no other way of saying it. The narwhal said that a sorcerer like himself can fill up the hole anytime, but that filling is only a patch without luminosity. Anyone who sees or does dreaming can tell that it looks like a lead patch on the yellow luminosity of the rest of the body. The narwhal patched you and me and Soledad, but then he left it up to us to put back the shine, the luminosity. How did he patch us? He's a sorcerer. He put things in our bodies. He replaced us. We are no longer the same. The patch is what he put in there himself. But how did he put those things there, and what were they? What he put in our bodies was his own luminosity, and he used his hands to do it. He simply reached into our bodies and left his fibers there. He did that with the same with all the six children, and also with Soledad. All of them are the same, except Soledad. She's something else. Lagorda seemed unwilling to go on. She facilitated and almost began to stutter. What is Donna Soledad? I insisted. It's very hard to tell, she said, after considerable coaxing. She is the same as you and me, and yet she's different. She has the same luminosity, but she's not together with us. She goes in the opposite direction. Right now, she's more like you. Both of you have patches that look like lead. Mine is gone, and I'm again a complete luminous egg. That is the reason I said that you and I will be exactly the same someday when you become complete again. Right now, what makes us almost the same is the narwhal's luminosity and the fact that both of us are going in the same direction and that we both were empty. What does a complete person look like to a sorcerer, I asked. Like a luminous egg made out of fiber, she said. All the fibers are complete. They look like strings, taut strings. It looks as if the strings have been tightened, like a drum is tightened. On an empty person, on the other hand, the fibers are crumpled up at the edges of the hole. When they have had many children, the fibers don't look like fibers anymore. Those people look like two chunks of luminosity. Those people look like two chunks of luminosity, separated by blackness. It's an awesome sight. The narwhal made me see them one day when we were in the park in the city. Why do you think the narwhal never told me about all this? He told you everything, but you never understood him correctly. As soon as he realized that you were not understanding what he was saying, he was compelled to change the subject. Your emptiness prevented you from understanding. The narwhal said that it was perfectly natural for you not to understand. Once a person becomes incomplete, he is actually empty like a gourd that has been hollowed out. It didn't matter to you how many times he told you that you were empty. It didn't matter that he even explained it to you. You never knew what he meant, or worse yet, you didn't want to know. Lagorda was treading on dangerous ground. I tried to head her off with another question, but she rebuffed me. You love a little boy and you don't want to understand. You love a little boy and you don't want to understand what the narwhal meant, she said accusingly. The narwhal told me that you have a daughter you've never seen, and that you love that little boy. One took your edge, the other pinned you down. You have welded them together. I had to stop writing. I crawled out of the cave and stood up. I began to walk down the steep incline of the floor of the gully. Lagorda followed me. She asked me if I was upset by her directness. I did not want to lie. Oops, here we go. What do you think? I asked. "You're fuming," she explained, and giggled with an abandon that I had witnessed only with Don and Don Juan and Don Gennaro. She seemed to lose her balance and grabbed my left arm. In order to help her get down to the floor of the gully, I lifted her up by the waist. I thought that she would not have weighed more than 100 pounds. She puckered her lips the way Don Gennaro used to and said that her weight was 115. We both laughed at once. It was a moment of direct, instant communication. "Why does it bother you so much to talk about these things?" she asked. I told her that once I had had a little boy whom I had loved immensely. I felt the imperative to tell her about him. Some extravagant need beyond my comprehension made me open up with that woman, who was a total stranger to me. As I began to talk about the little boy, a wave of nostalgia enveloped me. Perhaps it was the place, or the situation, or the time of day. Somehow I had merged the memory of that little boy with the memory of Don Juan, and for the first time in all the time I had not seen him, I missed Don Juan. Lydia had said that they never missed him because he was always with them. He was their bodies and their spirits. I had known instantly what she meant. I felt the same way myself. In that gully, however, an unknown feeling had overtaken me. I told LaGuardia that I had never missed Don Juan until that moment. She did not answer. She looked away. Possibly my feelings of longing for those two people had to do with the fact that both of them had produced catharsis, get that one out, in my life, and both of them were gone. I had not realized until that moment how final that separation was. I said to LaGuardia that the little boy had been, more than anything else, my friend, and that one day he was whisked away by forces I could not control. That was perhaps one of the greatest blows I had ever received. I even went to see Don Juan to ask his assistance. It was the only time I had ever asked for help. He listened to my plea, and then he broke into uproarious laughter. His reaction was so unexpected that I could not even get angry. I could only comment on what I thought was his insensitivity. "What do you want me to do?" he asked. I said that since he was a sorcerer, perhaps he could help me to regain my little friend for my solace. "You're wrong. A warrior doesn't seek anything for his solace," he said, in a tone that did not admit reproach. He then proceeded to smash my arguments. He said that a warrior could not possibly leave anything to chance, that a warrior actually affected the outcome of events by the force of his awareness and by his unbending intent. He said that if I would have had unbending intent to keep and help that child, I would have taken measures to assure his staying with me. But as it was, my love was merely a word, a useless outburst of an empty man. He then told me something about emptiness and completeness, and I did not want to hear it. All I felt was a sense of loss, and the emptiness that he had mentioned, I was sure, referred to the feelings of having lost someone irreplaceable. "You loved him. You honored his spirit. You wished him well. Now you must forget him," he said. But I had not been able to do so. There was something terribly alive in my emotions, even though time had mellowed them. At one point, I thought I had forgotten, but then one night, an incident produced the deepest emotional upheaval in me. I was walking to my office when a young Mexican woman approached me. She had been sitting on a bench waiting for a bus. She wanted to know if that particular bus went to a children's hospital. I did not know. She explained that a little boy had a high temperature for a long time and she was worried because she did not have any money. I moved towards the bench and saw a little boy standing on the seat with his head against the back of the bench. He was wearing a jacket and short pants and a cap. He could not have been more than 2 years old. He must have seen me, for he walked to the edge of the bench and put his head on my leg. "My little head hurts," he said in Spanish. His voice was so tiny and his dark eyes so sad that a wave of irrepressible anguish welled up in me. I picked him up and drove him and his mother to the nearest hospital. I left them there and gave the mother enough money to pay the bill. But I did not want to stay or to know any more about him. I wanted to believe that I had helped him and that by doing so I had paid back to the spirit of man. I had learned that the magical act of paying back to the spirit of man from Don Juan. I had asked him once, overwhelmed by the realization that I could never pay him back for all he had done for me, if there was anything in the world I could do to even the score. We were leaving a bank after exchanging some Mexican currency. "I don't need you to pay me back," he said. "But if you still want to pay back, make your deposit to the spirit of man. That's always a very small account, and whatever one puts in it is more than enough." By helping that sick child, I had merely paid back to the spirit of man for any help that my little boy may have received from strangers along his path. I told Lagorda that my love for him would remain alive for the rest of my life, even though I would never see him again. I wanted to tell her that the memory I had of him was buried so deep that nothing could touch it, but I desisted. I felt that I could have been superfluous. It would have been superfluous to talk about it. Besides, it was getting dark, and I wanted to get out of that gully. "We better go," I said. "I'll take you home. Maybe some other time we can talk about those things again." She laughed the way Don Juan used to laugh at me. I had apparently said something utterly funny. "Why do you laugh, Lagorda?" I asked. "Because you know yourself we can't leave this place just like that," she said. "You have an appointment with power here, and so do I." She crawled back into the cave, and she crawled back to the cave and crawled in. "Come on in," she yelled from inside. "There is no way to leave." I reacted most incongruously. I crawled in and sat next to her again. It was evident that she too had tricked me. I had not come here to have any confrontations. I should have been furious. I was indifferent instead. I could not lie to myself that I had only stopped there on my way to Mexico City. I had gone there compelled by something beyond my comprehension. She handed me my notebook and motioned me to write. She said that if I wrote, I would not only relax myself, but I would also relax her. "What is this appointment with power?" I asked. "The Narwhal told me that you and I have an appointment here with something out there. You first had an appointment with Soledad, then one with the Little Sisters. They were supposed to destroy you. The Narwhal said that if you survived their assaults, I had to bring you here so that we together could keep the third appointment." "What kind of appointment is it?" "I really don't know. Like everything else, it depends on us. Right now, there are some things out there that have been waiting for you. I say that they have been waiting for you because I come here by myself all the time and nothing ever happens. But tonight is different. You are here and those things will come." "Why is the Narwhal trying to destroy me?" I asked. "He's not trying to destroy anybody," Lagorda exclaimed in protest. "You are his child. Now he wants you to be himself, more himself than any of us. But to be a true Narwhal, you have to claim your power. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been so careful in setting up Soledad and the Little Sisters to stalk you. He taught Soledad how to change her shape and rejuvenate herself. He made her construct a devilish floor in her room, a floor no one can oppose. You see, Soledad is empty, so the Narwhal set her up to do something gigantic. He gave her a task, a most difficult and dangerous task, but only one which was suited for her, and that was to finish you off. He told her that nothing could be more difficult than for one sorcerer to kill another. It's easier for an average man to kill a sorcerer, or for a sorcerer to kill an average man, but two sorcerers don't fit well at all. The Narwhal told Soledad that her best bet was to surprise you and scare you, and that's what she did. The Narwhal set her up to be a desirable woman so she could lure you into her room, and there her floor would have bewitched you, because, as I've said, no one, but no one can stand up to that floor. That floor was the Narwhal's masterpiece for Soledad. But you did something to her floor, and Soledad had to change her tactics in accordance with the Narwhal's instructions. He told her that if her floor failed and she could not frighten and surprise you, she had to talk to you and tell you everything you wanted to know. The Narwhal trained her to talk very well as her last resource, but Soledad could not overpower you even with that. Why was it so important to overpower me? She paused and peered at me. She cleared her throat and sat up straight. She looked out at the low roof of the cave and exhaled noisily through her nose. Soledad is a woman like myself, she said. I'll tell you something about my own life, and maybe you'll understand her. I had a man once. He got me pregnant when I was very young, and I had two daughters with him, one after the other. My life was hell. The man was a drunkard, and he beat me day and night. I hated him, and he hated me. I got fat like a pig. One day another man came along and told me that he liked me and wanted me to go with him to work in the city as a paid servant. He knew I was a hard-working woman and only wanted to exploit me. But my life was so miserable, I fell for it and went with him. He was worse than the first man, mean and fearsome. He couldn't stand me after a week or so, and he used to give me the worst beatings you can imagine. I thought he was going to kill me, and he wasn't even drunk, and all because I hadn't found work. Then he sent me to beg on the streets with a sick baby. He would pay the child's mother something from the money I got, and then he would beat me because I hadn't made enough. The child got sicker and sicker, and I knew that if it died while I was begging, the woman would kill me. So one day, when I knew that he was not there, I went to the child's mother and gave her the baby with some money I had made that day. That was a lucky day for me. A foreign lady had given me 50 pesos to buy medicine for the baby. I had been with that horrible man for 3 months, and I thought it had been 20 years. I used the money to go back to my home. I was pregnant again. The man wanted me to have a child of my own, so that he would not have to pay for one. When I got to my hometown, I tried to go back to see my children, but they had been taken away from their father's family. All the family had got together under the pretense that they wanted to talk to me, but instead they took me to a deserted place and beat me with sticks and rocks and left me for dead. Lagorda showed me the many scars on her scalp. To this day, I don't know how I made it back to town. I even lost the child I had in my womb. I went to an aunt I still had. My parents were dead. She gave me a place to rest, and she tended to me. She fed me, the poor soul, for 2 months before I could get up. Then one day my aunt told me that man was in town looking for me. He had talked to the police and had said that he had given me money in advance to work, and I had run away, stealing the money after I had killed a woman's baby. I knew that the end had come for me, but my luck turned right again, and I caught a ride in a truck of an American. I saw the truck coming on the road, and I lifted my hand in desperation, and the man stopped and let me get on. He drove me all the way to this part of Mexico. He dropped me in the city. I didn't know a soul. I roamed all over the place for days like a crazy dog, eating garbage from the street. That was when my luck turned for the last time. I met Pablito, with whom I have a debt that I can never pay back. Pablito took me to his carpentry shop and gave me a corner there to put my bed. He did that because he felt sorry for me. He found me in the market after he stumbled and fell on top of me. I was sitting there begging. A moth or a bee, I don't know which, flew to him and hit him in the eye. He turned around on his heels and stumbled and fell right on top of me. I thought he would be so mad that he would hit me, but he gave me some money instead. I asked him if he could give me work. That was when he took me to his shop and set me up with an iron and an ironing board to do laundry. I did very well, except that I got fatter because most of the people I washed for fed me with their leftovers. Sometimes I ate 16 times a day. I did nothing else but eat. Kids in the street used to taunt me and sneak behind me and step on my heels. Then someone would push me and I would fall. Those kids made me cry with their cruel jokes, especially when they used to spoil my wash on purpose. One day, very late in the afternoon, a weird old man came over to see Pablito. I had never seen that man before. I had never known that Pablito was in cahoots with such a scary, awesome man. I turned my back to him and kept on working. I was alone there. Suddenly, I felt the hands of that old man on my neck. My heart stopped. I could not scream. I could not even breathe. I fell down, and that awful man held my head, maybe for an hour. Then he left. I was so frightened that I stayed where I had fallen. I was so frightened that I stayed where I had fallen until the next morning. Pablito found me there. He laughed and said that I should be very proud and happy because the old man was a very powerful sorcerer and was one of his teachers. I was dumbfounded. I couldn't believe Pablito was a sorcerer. He said that his teacher had seen a perfect circle of moths flying over my head. He had also seen my death circling around me, and that was why he acted like lightning and had changed the direction of my eyes. Pablito also said the Nawal had laid his hands on me and had reached into my body and that soon I would be different. I had no idea what he was talking about. I had no idea what that crazy old man had done either, but it didn't matter to me. I was like a dog that everyone kicked around. Pablito had been the only person who had been kind to me. At first I thought he wanted me to be his woman, but I was too ugly and fat and smelly. He just wanted to be kind to me. The crazy old man came back another night and grabbed me again by the back by the neck from behind. He hurt me terribly. I cried and screamed. I did not know what he was doing. He never said a word to me. I was deathly afraid of him. He never said a word to me. Then later on, he began to talk to me and told me what to do with my life. I like what he said. He told me everywhere. He took me everywhere with him. But my emptiness was my worst enemy. I couldn't accept his ways. So one day, he got sick and tired of pampering me and sent the wind after me. I was in the back of Soledad's house by myself that day, and I felt the wind getting very strong. It was blowing through the fence. It got into my eyes. I wanted to get inside the house, but my body was frightened. And instead of walking through the door, I walked through the gate and the fence. The wind pushed me and made me twirl. I tried to go back to the house, but it was useless. I couldn't break the force of the wind. It pushed me over the hills and off the road, and I ended up in a deep hole, a hole like a tomb. The wind kept me there for days and days until I had decided to change and accept my fate without recrimination. Then the wind stopped and the Nawal found me and took me back to the house. He told me that my task was to give what I didn't have, love and affection, and that I had to take care of the sisters, Lydia and Josephina, better than if they were myself. I understood then that what the Nawal had been saying to me for years. My life had been over a long time ago. He had offered me a new life, and that life had to be completely new. I couldn't bring to that new life my ugly old ways. The first night he found me, the moths had pointed me out to him. I had no business rebelling against my fate. I began my change by taking care of Lydia and Josephina better than I could took care of myself. I did everything the Nawal told me. And one night, in this very gully, in this very cave, I found my completeness. I had fallen asleep right here, where I am now, and then a noise woke me up. I looked up and saw myself as I had once been, thin, young, and fresh. It was my spirit that was coming back to me. At first, I didn't want it to come closer because I still looked pretty awful. But then I couldn't help myself and came to me. But then it couldn't help itself, and it came to me. I knew right then, and all at once, what the narwhal had struggled for years to tell me. He had said that when one has a child, that child takes the edge off our spirit. For a woman to have a girl means the end of that edge. To have two girls, as I did, meant the end of me. The mess my strength and my illusion, the best of my strength and my illusions went to those girls. They stole my edge. The narwhal said, in the same way I had stolen it from my parents. That's our fate. A boy steals the biggest part of his edge from his father, a girl from her mother. The narwhal said that people who have had children could tell if they aren't as stubborn as you. That's because something is missing in them. Some craziness, some nervousness, some power that they had before is gone. They used to have it, but where is it now? The narwhal said that it is in the little child running around the house, full of energy, full of illusions. In other words, complete. He said that if we watch the child, we can tell that they are daring. They move in leaps. If we watch their parents, we can see that they are cautious and timid. They don't leap anymore. The narwhal told me, explained that by saying that the parents are, we explain that by saying that the parents are grown-ups and have responsibilities. But that's not true. The truth of the matter is that they have lost their edge. All right, I get it. I asked Lagorda what the narwhal would have said if I had told him that I knew parents with much more spirit and edge than their children. She laughed, covering her face in a gesture of sham embarrassment. You can ask him, she said, giggling. You want to hear what I think? Of course I want to hear it. Those people don't have any more spirit. They merely had a lot of vigor to begin with, and they have trained their children to be obedient and meek. They have frightened their children all their lives. That's all. I described to her the case of a man I knew, a father of four, who at the age of 53 changed his life completely. That entailed leaving his wife and an executive job in a large corporation after more than 25 years of building a career and a family. He chucked it all and very daringly went to live on an island in the Pacific. You mean he went there all by himself, Lagorda said in a tone of surprise. She had destroyed my argument. I had to admit that the man had gone there with his 23-year-old bride, who no doubt is complete, Lagorda added. I had to agree with her again. An empty man uses the completeness of a woman all the time, she went on. A complete woman is dangerous in her completeness, more so than a man. She is unreliable, moody, nervous, but also capable of great changes. Women like that can pick themselves up and go anywhere. They'll do nothing there, but that's because they had nothing going to begin with. Empty people, on the other hand, can't jump like that anymore. They are more reliable. The narwhal said that empty people are like worms. They look around before they move a bit, and then they back up, and then they move a little bit more again. Complete people always jump, somersault, and almost always land on their heads, but it doesn't matter to them. The narwhal said, to enter into the other world, one has to be complete. To be a sorcerer, one has to have all of one's luminosity, no holes, no patches, all the edge of the spirit. So a sorcerer who is empty has to regain completeness, man or woman. They must be complete or enter into the world out there, that eternity where the narwhal and Gennaro are now waiting for us. Monk, cut it out, will you? She stopped talking and stared at me for a long moment. There was barely enough light to write. How did you regain your completeness? I asked. She jumped at the sound of my voice. I repeated my question. She stared up at the roof of the cave before answering me. I had to refuse those two girls, she said. The Narwhal once told me. You told you how to do that, but you didn't want to hear it. His point was that one has to steal that edge back. He said that we got it the hard way by stealing it, and that we must recover it the same way, the hard way. He guided me to do that. The first thing he made me do was to refuse my love for those two children. I had to do that in dreaming. Little by little, I learned not to like them. But the Narwhal said that that was useless. One has to learn not to care and not to like. Whenever those girls meant nothing to me, I had to see them again, lay my eyes and my hands on them. I had to pat them gently on the head and let my left side snatch the edge from out of them. What happened to them? Nothing. They never felt a thing. They went home and are now like two grown-up persons, empty like most people around them. They don't like the company of children because they have no use for them. I would say that they are better off. I took the craziness out of them. They didn't need it, while I did. I didn't know what I was doing when I gave it to them. Besides, they still retain the edge they stole from their father. The Narwhal was right. No one noticed the loss, but I did notice my gain. As I looked out of this cave, I saw all my illusions lined up like a row of soldiers. The world was bright and new. The heaviness of my body and my spirit had been lifted off, and I was truly a new being. Do you know how you took your edge from your children? They're not my children. I have never had any. Look at me. She crawled out of the cave, lifted her skirt, and showed me her naked body. The first thing I noticed was how slender and muscular she was. She urged me to come closer and examine her. Her body was so lean and firm that I had to conclude that she could not possibly have had children. She put her right leg on a high rock and showed me her vagina. Her drive to prove her change was so intense that I had to laugh to bridge my nervousness. I said that I was not a doctor and I therefore could not tell, but that I was sure she must be right. Of course I'm right, she said as she crawled back into the cave. Nothing has ever come out of that womb. After a moment's pause, she answered my question, which I had already forgotten under the onslaught of her display. My left side took my edge back, she said. All I did was go and visit the girls. I went there 4 or 5 times to allow them to feel at ease with me. They were big girls and they were going to school. I thought I would have to fight to like them. But the Narwhal said that it didn't matter, that I should like them if I wanted to. So I liked them. But my liking them was just like liking a stranger. My mind was made up. My purpose was unbending. I wanted to enter into that other world while I was still alive, as the Narwhal told me. And in order to do so, I needed all the edge of my spirit. I needed my completeness. Nothing can turn me away from that world. Nothing. She stared at me defiantly. You have to refuse both the woman who emptied you and the little boy who has your love if you are seeking your completeness. The woman you can easily refuse. The little boy is something else. Do you think that your useless affection for that child is so worthy as to keep you from entering into that realm? I had no answer. It was not that I wanted to think it over. It was rather that I had become utterly confused. Soledad has to take her edge out of Pablito if she wants to enter into the Narwhal, she went on. How in the hell is she going to do that? Pablito, no matter how weak he is a sorcerer. But the Narwhal gave Soledad a unique chance. He said to her that her only moment would come when you walked into her house. And for that moment, he not only made us move out into the other house, but he made us help her widen the path to the house so you could drive your car very close to the door. He told her that if she lived an impeccable life, she would bag you and suck away all your luminosity, which is all the power of the Nawal left inside your body. That would not be difficult for her to do, since she was going in the opposite direction. She could drain you to nothing. Her great feat was to lead you to a moment of helplessness. Once she had killed you, your luminosity would have increased her power, and she would then have come after us. I was the only one who knew that. Lydia, Josephina, and Rosa love her. I don't. I knew what her designs were. She would have taken us all one by one in her own time, since she had nothing to lose and everything to gain. The Nawal said to me that there was no other way for her. He entrusted me with the girls and told me what to do in case Soldad killed you and came after our luminosity. He figured that I had a chance to save myself and to save perhaps one of the three. You see, Soldad is not a bad woman at all. She's simply doing what an impeccable warrior would do. The little sisters like her more than they like their own mothers. She's a real mother to them. That was what the Nawal said, the point of her advantage. I hadn't been able to pull the little sisters away from her, no matter what I do. So if she had killed you, she would then have taken at least two of those three trusted souls. Then without you in the picture, Pablito was nothing. Soldad would have squashed him like a bug. And then, with all her completeness and power, she would have entered into the world out there. If I had been in her place, I would have tried to do exactly as she did. So you see, it was all for nothing for her. When she first arrived, everyone was gone. When you first arrived, everyone was gone. It looked as if it was the end for you and for some of us. But then at the end, it was nothing for her and a chance for the sisters. The moment I knew that you had succeeded, I told the three girls that now it was their turn. The Nawal had said that they should wait until the morning to catch you unawares. He said that the morning was not a good time for you. He commanded me to stay away and not interfere with the sisters, and to come in only if you would try to injure their luminosity. Were they supposed to kill me too? Well, yes, you were the male side of their luminosity. Their completeness is at times their disadvantage. The Nawal ruled them with an iron hand and balanced them. But now that he's gone, they have no way of leveling off. Your luminosity would have done that for them. How about you, Gorda? Are you supposed to finish me off too? I told you already that I am different. I am balanced. My emptiness, which was my disadvantage, is now my advantage. Once a sorcerer regains his completeness, he is balanced, like a sorcerer who is always complete is a bit off, like Gennaro was a bit off. But the Nawal was balanced because he had been incomplete, like you and me, even more so than you and me. He had three sons and one daughter. The little sisters are like Gennaro, a bit off, and most of the time so taught that they have no measure. How about me, Gorda? Do I also have to go after them? No, only they could have profited by sucking away your luminosity. You can't profit at all by anyone's death. The Nawal left a special power with you, a balance of some kind, which none of us has. Can't they learn to have that balance? Sure they can, but that has nothing to do with the task the little sisters had to perform. Their task was to steal your power. For that, they became so united that they are now one single being. They trained themselves to sip you up like a glass of soda. The Nawal set them up to be deceivers of the highest order, especially Josephina. She put on a show that was peerless. Compared to their art, Soldad's attempt was child's play. She's a crude woman. The little sisters are true sorceresses. Two of them gained your confidence, while the third shocked you and rendered you helpless. They played their cards to perfection. You fell for it all and nearly succumbed. The only flaw was that you injured and cured Rose's luminosity the night before, and that made her jumpy. Had it not been for her nervousness and her biting your side so hard, chances are you wouldn't be here now. I saw everything from the door. I came in at the precise moment you were about to annihilate them. But what could I do to annihilate them? How could I know that? I'm not you. I mean, what do you see me doing? I saw your double coming out of you. What did it look like? It looked like you. What else? But it was very big and menacing. Your double would have killed them. So I came in and interfered with it. It took the best of my power to calm you down. The little sisters were no help. They were lost. And you were furious and violent. You changed colors right in front of us twice. Your color was so violent that I feared you would kill me too. What color was I, Magorda? White, what else? The double is white, yellowish white like the sun. I stared at her. Her smile was very new to me. Yes, she continued. We are pieces of the sun. That is why we are luminous beings. But our eyes can't see that luminosity because it is very faint. Only the eyes of a sorcerer can see it, and that happens after a lifetime of struggle. Her revelation had taken me by total surprise. I tried to reorganize my thoughts in order to ask the most appropriate question. Did the Nawal ever tell you anything about the sun? I asked. Yes, we are all like the sun, but very, very faint. A light is too weak, but it is light anyway. But did he say that the sun is perhaps the Nawal? I insisted desperately. Lagorda did not answer. She made a series of involuntary noises with her lips. She was apparently thinking how to answer my probe. I waited readily to write it down. After a long pause, she crawled out of the cave. I'll show you my faint light, she said matter-of-factly. She walked to the center of a narrow gully in front of the cave and squatted. From where I was, I could not see what she was doing, so I had to get out of the cave myself. I stood 10 or 12 feet away from her. She put her hands under her skirt while she was still squatting. Suddenly, she stood up. Her hands were loosely clasped into fists. She raised them over her head and snapped her fingers open. I heard a quick bursting sound, and I saw sparks flying from her fingers. She again clasped her hands and then snapped them open, and another volley of much larger sparks flew out of them. She squatted once again and reached under her skirt. She seemed to be pulling something from her pubis. She repeated the snapping movement of her fingers as she threw her hands over her head, and I saw a spray of long, luminous fibers flying away from her fingers. I had to tilt my head up to see them against the already dark sky. They appeared to be long, fine filaments of a reddish light. After a while, they faded and disappeared. She squatted once again, and then she let her fingers open a most astonishing display of lights emanating from them. The light was filled with dark rays of light. It was a spellbinding sight. I became engrossed in it. My eyes were fixed. I was not paying attention to Lagorda. I was looking at the lights. I heard a sudden outcry that forced me to look at her, just in time to see her grab one of the lines she was creating and spin to the very top of the canyon. She hovered there for an instant like a dark, huge shadow against the sky, then descended to the bottom of the gully in spurts or small leaps, as if she were coming down a stairway on her belly. I suddenly saw her standing over me. I had not realized that I had fallen on my seat. I stood up. She was soaked in perspiration and was panting, trying to catch her breath. She could not speak for a long time. She began to jog in place. I did not dare touch her. Finally, she seemed to have calmed down enough to crawl back into the cave. She rested for a few moments. Her action seemed to have been so fast that I could hardly had any time to evaluate what had happened. At the moment of her display, I had felt an unbearable ticklish pain in the area just below my navel. I had not physically exerted myself, and yet I was also panting. "I think it is time to go to our appointment," she said, out of breath. My flying opened us both. "You felt my flying in your belly, and that means you are open and ready to meet the four forces." End of part one of chapter 3.